I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The nation paused to remember former President Gerald Ford today at a state funeral at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. Ford died last week at the age of 93. President Bush declared today a national day of mourning and delivered one of the tributes at the ceremonies.
In President Ford, the world saw the best of America. And America found a man whose character and leadership would bring calm and healing to one of the most divisive moments in our nation's history.
Former Presidents Jimmy Carter, George H.W. Bush, and Bill Clinton were among the 3,000 people attending the invitation-only funeral services. Richard Wolff is senior White House correspondent for Newsweek, and he joins us to talk about the ceremony. And Richard, very elaborate ceremony today. What were some of the moments that stood out for you?
Well, firstly, a stylistic point, the use of a hearse instead of the horse, the elaborate, more elaborate funeral procession that we saw with President Reagan, but also the sense of warmth and humor we heard at the National Cathedral service. I thought that was a really striking thing today.
As we said, President Bush was among those delivering tributes today. There was also former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, NBC newsman Tom Brokaw. What are your thoughts about Tom Brokaw being asked to give a tribute today?
Well, obviously, being a journalist, I thought that was a fascinating thing. For just to start, the decision to have someone representing the Ford Press Corps there at this moment, and I've spoken to a number of older reporters who covered the Ford presidency, and all of them have the kinds of stories that Tom Brokaw shared, really very personal, about President Ford reaching out to reporters, being incredibly accessible, and it just feels to someone covering this White House like a very, very different era, and really a mark of President Ford's genuine warmth and decency as a person.
Vice President Cheney was one of the honorary pallbearers. He was not among those speaking today, but you say that the eulogy he gave Saturday was very remarkable. What did he say?
Yes, this was at the Capitol, and really, obviously, Vice President Cheney, as a young chief of staff to President Ford, really had this unique perspective. I think his eulogy was really quite touching for someone who is known to be very reticent and guarded in public and even in private. And he said that President Ford really was perhaps the only person to recognize how important it was for the country to heal. But also his description of President Ford. He said that President Ford, and I'm quoting here, was modest and manful. There was confidence and courage in his bearing. Modest and manful, it struck me as a very peculiar turn of phrase that spoke volumes about how presidents operate as people and how these very senior officials interact with each other. I thought it captured the man wonderfully well, modest and manful.
Yeah. Although it was a somber day, there were a couple of moments of levity. Most notably, former President H.W. Bush remarked about how President Ford poked fun at himself and his terrible golf game.
I know I'm playing better golf, President Ford once reported to friends, but I'm hitting fewer spectators. He had a wonderful sense of humor. And even took it in stride when Chevy Chase had to make the entire world think that this terrific, beautifully coordinated athlete was actually a stumbler. But Ford says it was funny. He wrote that in his memoir. I remember that lesson well, since being able to laugh at yourself is essential in public life. I'll tell you more about that, but as Dana Carvey would say, not gonna do it. Wouldn't be prudent. Now,
is that, Richard, the warmth you were talking about? Is that
absolutely? Yeah. And it's nice that they can make fun of this. I've read much about President Ford where he really actually genuinely didn't like the Chevy Chase impression. But and I don't think former President Bush liked his impressions much. But it's a mark of, I guess, being an elder statesman that they can see the humor in it now. You know, that levity is an important part of these remembrances, because that's what this, especially these state events, are. The more private, more emotional ceremony follows tomorrow, but this is really a celebration.
Well, Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Anytime.
Ah. how many hours do you work a week? 40? 60? More? Well, a growing number of experts say the 40-hour work week is becoming a thing of the past. In fact, for many people considered high-earning Americans, a 75-hour work week is the norm, and that's without a commute. A recent article in the Harvard Business Review explores the growing phenomenon of what it calls the extreme job, or the American dream on steroids. It says not only are more people working more than 60 hours a week, most of them say they enjoy it. Sylvia Hewlett is co-author of the article titled Extreme Jobs, The Dangerous Allure of the 70-Hour Work Week. She's also president of the Center for Work-Life Policy, a New York-based nonprofit organization. Welcome, Sylvia.
It's good to be with you, Deb.
Let's, first of all, start out with how you define an extreme job. What is an extreme job?
Well, you know, it's an interesting definition because it's not just long hours. In order to be defined as an extreme worker, you do have to be working more than 60 hours a week. But you also need to have five other performance pressures, and they range from, you know, 24/7 client demands to all kinds of power breakfasts and, you know, business dinners to the global span of control to things like P&L responsibility. So in order to be an extreme worker, you have the 60-plus hours a week plus at least five of what we call these performance pressures.
In this article in the Harvard Business Review, you mention a financial analyst who is working 90 hours a week, and this is during what he calls his light season. Regularly,
right.
He could go to 120 hours a week, mm-hmm. but I think the shocker here is that he's 23 years old, and he's making quite a big salary, but he's working an awful lot. Now, was this sort of a unusual example, or were there a lot of workers that you found like this financial analyst?
Well, you know, half of our extreme workers in this study were working more than 70 hours a week. And if you think about what that translates into in terms of, you know, quality of life, it's pretty brutal.
Right.
It's really, you know, 10 hours a day, 7 days a week. Add in a commute, and really there's no time for anything else.
So we're not just talking about workaholics here, though, are we?
We're not. And, you know, obviously, in every age, there have been people who you know, torture themselves with high expectations, see themselves as, you know, in love with their jobs, etc. But I think today we're talking about a much wider group. What we show is that these kinds of jobs are expanding all over the economy, many more people working these kinds of hours. And that's because, you know, the global environment's really changed. Take modern communication technology. In these days of, you know, email, cell phones, and who knows what else, your boss can get at you at, you know, 7 a.m. Sunday morning, as well as 9 o'clock, you know, Friday evening. And there is this kind of always-on culture.
Hmm. So in part, it's because that's what companies are expecting from workers right now, would you say?
I think so. And, of course, the other thing that's changed is global competitive pressures have really ratcheted up. We're all aware of the fact that there's lots of, you know, low-cost producers coming on stream.
Why do you think that so many people are working like this? Is it, I mean, I'm sure it's not just because, my company's demanding it of me in order for me to get ahead. I must do this. I mean, is there something also about this kind of pressure that really attracts a certain type of people?
Well, you know, personally, the biggest surprise in this study for me was that about 70% of these extreme workers adored their jobs. They talked about it almost like a drug. You know, they talked about the adrenaline rush and the high and the exhilaration. And I think, you know, the good news in this study is that there are a lot of knowledge workers these days who see their work as self-actualizing. And, you know, 60% of these workers, for instance, said that the pressures were not produced by Big Brother, by the big boss, but they were self-inflicted.
What about the lifestyle consequences, though?
Well, you know, this is where the tension comes in, because on the one hand, you know, these jobs are very seductive, very alluring, but the costs attached to them are extremely real. We have a lot of data in terms of the fallout on personal health, the fallout in intimate lives, the fallout on families, We find, for instance, that many are addicted to sleeping medications, because if you, you know, do enough global travel, your body clock gets totally off kilter. There's a desperate squeezing of the time spent with children, particularly women who hold extreme jobs, are ridden with guilt.
Right. So one of the things that you point out in this article is the fact that of these extreme job holders, only 20% are women.
Absolutely.
So that's got to be in part because a lot of these women who are raising children are saying that they're not going to do the hours that it might take to succeed in that kind of a culture.
Absolutely. And the picture around women is very disturbing. We find that women are very reluctant to opt into these jobs because they do understand how punishing they are, and they are much more likely to leave them rather quickly. So if all of the top jobs in our economy are increasingly like this, what it means is that the extreme work model is kind of leaving women behind in new ways. A lot of companies, you know, see these workers as their bench strength for the future, where they're going to recruit their leaders. And so I think that the repercussions on, you know, female progress, on the acceleration of women's careers, all of those things look pretty bad.
So would you say then that the American workforce, or at least the high-earning individuals in the workforce, can sustain the kind of lifestyle that would be required if extreme jobs are to become more the norm?
Well, you know, what we find in the data, three groups are beginning to balk, to say, hey, guys, you don't want to do this for, you know, more than another year, and that's kind of the question we ask them. As we mentioned before, women are bailing out. But the other groups that are also very reluctant to take on board this kind of work reality are the older baby boomers. You know, the 58-year-old successful man does not want to retire, but he surely doesn't want to continue to do 70-hour weeks.
Right.
And the other group that is very skittish when it comes to this model of how to work is the millennial generation, the workers ages, you know, 25 to 30. There's a lot of evidence in this study that they're balking too. So I think there will be a little bit of a revolt. There are beginning attempts to kind of chunk out work in different ways to kind of tame this work model so that you don't lose too much of your key talent.
All right. Well, Sylvia, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Sylvia Hewlett is co-author of the article titled Extreme Jobs, the Dangerous Allure of the 70-Hour Work Week. The article appeared in last month's edition of the Harvard Business Review. She's also president of the Center for Work-Life Policy. Just ahead, the worker's point of view. We hear from one attorney who likes putting in all those hours. Stay with us. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. We've been talking about the growth of what the Harvard Business Review calls extreme jobs, where an average work week is about 75 hours. Well, 35-year-old Alex Southwell is profiled in an article in the review, and he has an extreme job. He's a federal prosecutor in New York City, and he usually works between 75 and 95 hours a week. He also has two young children. I asked Alex to describe his average work week.
I often get into the office around 9:30. I tend to get in a little bit later because I try to spend some time with my kids in the morning. And many times during the week, I stay until 11. Or maybe I'll be home for a little bit of time before my kids go to bed, and then I'll work for another 3 or 4 hours at home. So sometimes, as a prosecutor, I'm a trial attorney, and often I will be on trial, and those hours are even more. I mean, often I'll be working from 8 a.m. to midnight 7 days a week.
And why is that? I mean, they sound like unbelievable hours.
We have, just an incredibly large caseload, primarily, I think it's because there's an awful lot of things out there to prosecute, and we work very hard to do it in the best possible way.
Do you think if you were another type of prosecutor, you wouldn't have to work those kinds of hours?
Well, no, I think, it's an unfortunate reality that a lot of government jobs, be it federal or state, you know, if prosecutors' offices are understaffed, and, you know, either you work these kinds of hours or there are cases that go unprosecuted.
So is that what you think motivates you to keep up those long hours?
Yeah. I mean, I do primarily securities fraud cases, and so I'm often motivated by the victims of the cases. I mean, there are people who have lost their life savings and lost their financial security, and often, you know, an emotional and psychic security that goes with that, people who are devastated, and I'm their advocate. I'm the one who is prosecuting the person who has caused them that harm and working to make sure that the people responsible are brought to justice. You know, it's a very important responsibility and an obligation that I take on, and I'm proud to do that service.
Do you think your hours affect your lifestyle?
Yeah, I mean, they certainly do. Mm-hmm. It is hard to keep up, you know, the ideal relationship with my kids and my wife that I would like to. I think we do our best. We try to, you know, it's hard to keep our home in good shape. I don't really get to the gym as often as I really should, and I haven't been to the doctor in quite a while. There's little things on my side that I just have to let go because I just can't fit it all in.
Does your wife work outside of the home?
She does. Yeah, she works part time. I mean, she does work. It has a great deal of flexibility, which is really important for us.
Well, I have to ask, if your regular work week is 75 hours a week, what's part time? Is it part time or is it 40 hours a week?
Yeah, I mean, it does. It seems like that. I mean, I had actually, my wife was away on business a few weeks ago, and I had to be home by 5:30 to. So that our babysitter could go home, and, you know, I was remarking on how little I could actually get done. I mean, how little I could get done. I was getting, certainly getting work done, but just not as much.
So how do you think that long hours affect your parenting? Are you able to work those hours and be an effective parent?
You know, I think so. There are times when I question that, I try very hard. I really try to spend time with them in the mornings, getting them up and getting them ready and out. I miss out on putting them to bed a lot, and that bothers me. My wife's very good with them, so that's, they're in good hands, but I would like to be there, and my 4.5-year-old has been a little defiant lately, and striking the right balance of discipline and firmness about little things like brushing teeth and things like that is hard, and it's hard if I'm not there regularly at bedtime, and I only come in on the weekends. I think it requires extra effort, certainly, and maybe at the margins it makes my job as a parent a lot harder, but I don't know, I like to think that she's still happy and healthy and will be successful.
If you didn't have to work so much, what would you do? I mean, maybe it's part of what you sort of like to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. I have a wonderful job where I feel like I'm doing important work, and I'm in court every day. And as a lawyer's job goes, a trial lawyer's job, that's a great thing, and it's a lot better. I'm getting a lot more out of it than I was when I was in private practice before I came to the government. I don't know. I think I would hopefully be a lot more involved in some community activities, which I'd like to be involved with, but just don't seem to have the time. And activities at my children's school. We try to be involved as much as we can, but it's not really that much.
So what would you say you get out of your extreme hours the most? Is it the when you say to yourself some days when it's all crashing in on you, I do this because, well, compensation, sense of satisfaction, the sense of purpose that you are prosecuting and helping these victims of securities fraud? Or what do you think is the main... main point of satisfaction for you?
I think it's the sense of purpose. I mean, it's a public service, and it's an honor and it's a privilege to have this job and to do it in the highest standards that my office is used to people doing it in, and that's, I think, how I drive the satisfaction of it. And it's I care about the cases and successfully and fairly bringing the cases and prosecuting the cases, and the money is not particularly good, especially compared to what I could make in private practice, although it does, having this job, many people, eventually leave the government sector and go back to private practice, and you can make a lot more there, having gotten the experience that I've gotten.
Well, good luck, Alex.
Thanks very much.
Alex Southwell is a federal prosecutor in New York. He's among the workers profiled in a Harvard Business Review article on the rise of so-called extreme jobs. For more, visit our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Democrats, who will control the 110th Congress, take office Thursday and say they plan to do things differently. 5-day work weeks, for one. They also say they won't take revenge on Republicans who shut them out of decision-making in the last Congress. The first female House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, is planning a flurry of what she calls easy-to-pass legislation at the start of the new Congress. Well, joining us on the line from Capitol Hill is Gail Chadwick. She's congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Happy New Year, Gail.
Happy New Year back at you.
Well, the Washington Post is reporting today that there's already a little bit of trouble, possibly. The newspaper says that despite promises of bipartisanship, the Democrats may sideline Republicans during the first 100 hours. What do you think of that?
I think that you could put the phrase, there's a little bit of trouble, on a rubber stamp and just put it on every story you write for the next 2 years. It's no surprise that it's coming up this early. But what the Democrats are trying to do here is to demonstrate quickly that they are capable of governing. That's why they're not opening things wide open to Republicans, and are capable of producing things that people will notice in their lives quickly. Mm. For example, the minimum wage, the change in the interest rate on student loans. This is the kind of thing that makes a difference in your life, and they want to get out of the block running on this.
But don't they run the risk here of being perceived anyway as being very arrogant if they don't handle it correctly?
Yes. They do. Mm-hmm. So I think around this you're going to hear a lot of kind of talk and justification that many of these issues have already been voted on, have already had support from Republicans. But I think you're exactly right. Having made these promises, it is incumbent on you to show some faith in holding them. My personal favorite is the 5-day work week. I note already that they're not coming in on Monday, which I take as a bad sign.
What about some of the other items on the short list for the first 100 hours in the House?
Well, I think another thing that people will watch closely is removal of a single line in legislation which currently bans the federal government from negotiating lower drug prices for seniors in the Medicare program, as they do for veterans. This is something that took a lot of heat because the chairman responsible for putting it into law went on to become the top lobbyist for the drug industry. Mm. However, Republicans and some Democrats, they're going to have trouble with Senate Democrats on this as well, feel that part of the rationale of that bill was to encourage competition between insurers and drug companies, and that is already producing lower drug prices. And if you get the government involved setting prices for drugs, it's going to limit the development of new drugs. I think you're going to see something like the argument over stem cell research, that it's going to limit life-saving cures down the line. This is going to be a very big battle, not the simple one it appeared in campaign ads.
Do you think that will hold true for a lot of these pieces of legislation when they move to the Senate? Where do you see the difficulty, if any, coming in when we go there?
I think there'll be a big fight over what constitutes ending the people's auction house and turning it back into the auction house. Anything to do with what the actual rules will be for regulating relations with lobbyists. That's a big bread-and-butter issue for members in both houses. And so while the promises are big, you know, no more K Street Project, no more corruption, there is so much money that goes back and forth, so many favors, so much contact, that it's going to be difficult to eliminate the appearance of influence there. Even something like banning lobbyist travel, the draft I've seen of what the actual language will be says, except for one day travel to visit a site, attend a forum. You know, it's the exceptions that are going to determine the clout of these pieces in the end.
Mm. Can you update us a little bit, Gail, on the condition of South Dakota Senator Tim Johnson? He was a Democrat, rushed to the hospital for surgery last month.
Right.
What happens if he can't serve in the Senate?
Nothing. This is the Senate. It's one of the last places on earth that has genuine, deep, and profound respect for both age and disability. There are senators who've been unable to serve for months and even years on end, and they continue to hold their seat because their colleagues do not want a third party to be able to point their finger at someone and say, you're not fit to serve. Senator Biden, who has served many years since brain aneurysm, I think was the diagnosis, was out for months and came back fully recovered. And that's what people are talking about with Senator Johnson, that they don't want to assume that he's not coming back. They don't want to take him out of the picture. The only one that can do that is him.
How about how this new Congress might react to the war in Iraq? Any talk there about steps such as maybe cutting some funding for the war or anything?
Oh, like that's huge. Mm. That's a huge issue. Right away, they're going to deal with two issues. The president's own plan for Iraq, which will likely include more troops sent in the short run, and also a request for more funding. Now, one thing that even the strongest critics of the war have yet to say, especially the key chairman, they are not threatening funds for troops in the field. And really, that is the ultimate sanction from Congress. No matter what these crusading new chairmen come up with, no matter how deep their investigations go, in the end, the commander-in-chief decides about the deployment of forces unless Congress pulls the plug. So far, they say they're not going to do that.
Mm. How do you think the president and the Congress will work together?
I think it's going to be very tough. I'm interested in what he says about the war. But you even have early on Republican senators, such as Senator Specter, traveling in countries like Syria that the State Department didn't want him to go, breaking with the White House on lots of fronts, willing to listen to what he has to say. But you can already see that this is a lame duck president. Members of Congress and the House are going to have to run, members of the Senate and House are going to have to run again, and they're making their own peace between their constituents and the war. I think you're going to see a very rough ride for the president on this front.
Mm, and of course, new Congress is taking office, and the pace of the 2008 presidential race is picking up. Massachusetts Republican Governor Mitt Romney is expected to form a presidential exploratory committee this week, and there are other names that are being floated about, like Illinois Senator Barack Obama and Hillary Rodham Clinton. Your thoughts about how this is playing into things?
I'm looking for something that your listeners might not have thought about, which is with this presidential race so important and so wide open, it's going to be very difficult for members of Congress to get money for their own campaigns. Who cares about Congress when something so important is on the line? So I'm looking for leadership early on to give the younger, newer members, many from marginal districts, a lot of exposure, a lot of time in Washington for fundraisers. That five-day work week might be not just what happens during the day, but those nighttime fundraisers, which can build up coffers in the first 6 months before the presidential race sucks all of the money out of the system.
All right. Gail, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Gail Chadwick is congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Still to come, how you doing with that New Year's resolution? Well, thought so. We'll tell you why they're so tough to keep. You're listening to Here and Now. After 9/11, performers in the Providence, Rhode Island-based group the Everett Dance Theater turned their home movies into a show about where we come from and where we're going. Everett Dance Theater is a family affair. It was founded by Dorothy Jungles. Her son Aaron and daughter Rachel play key roles on and off stage. The group just celebrated its 20th anniversary year. Here in Now's Lynn Menegon spoke with some of the performers at a rehearsal of home movies last January.
All of my friends were in gangs.
Join up, so.
A good friend of mine.
What's up?
He asked me.
So, you gonna join?
Huh? I don't know.
The parents of dancer Sokio Ross fled Cambodia to escape the Khmer Rouge.
As a performer, when I first started performing this, it was a little bit uncomfortable because I didn't know my story. So I had to, me and Aaron actually sat down and interviewed my parents for about 2 hours, and I found out, you know, a lot of things I didn't know. I learned 75% of my history through that interview and the process of making this piece. So for me to actually just learn that and then give it to the audience right away, it was kind of difficult for me. You know, it was hard for me to adjust.
We'll give you a deal. You get jumped in, but you don't get jumped out.
What's good, so?
And you didn't join the gang.
Nope. Fortunately, I didn't. So I'm here today.
If you had, would you be here today?
No, I'd probably be in jail or dead. Two choices.
I don't know.
That's it.
Do I want to? Do I not? Do I want to? Do I not? But he kept pressuring me.
You have 24 hours to get rid of the body. My father never took up life insurance. And my family had just gone bankrupt.
Dancer Bravel Smith describes the death of his father and not having enough money to bury him or buy the family home.
The owner, who's a friend of mine, said, I can have my father take him and we can hold him at our funeral home.
The company always works from personal stories. Dorothy spends a lot of hours. She videotapes everything we do in rehearsal. So we'll have a theme for this particular piece. It was home movies, home families. And we'll have a theme. And then we, the performers, different days we come to rehearsals and we have maybe a question. So, you know, tell us about an experience. This is just an example. Tell us about a moment that changed your life. Dorothy then asked us to create movement through improvisational games that we've gathered and created over the years.
Before my father died, he had a lawyer telling him he should be receiving money from the state for his disability. The checks finally came 2 months after he passed away. If the state had paid my family on time, we might not have lost our home. So many things may have been different. I remember my family pretty much fighting to keep our house, living there even after the bank had foreclosed on the property. If I ever had the money and the opportunity ever came up, I would buy this house. I would buy this house back for my mother.
I wanted to be a model, an actress, a dancer. I was 15. I knew what to wear and how to wear it. I look good.
Dancer Rachel Jungles studied dance at Juilliard in New York after a wild childhood.
He was the one guy that was a real sugar daddy. He'd take me out, buy me all kinds of presents. Girl from school in the club that night, she said to me, you know, you really shouldn't be messing with him. I found out he was a pimp.
We are also connected, and the man on the street has a story, and everybody has a story, and that it's you know, I think it's a brave thing to bring it on stage like this. You know, I realized that we were so engrossed in our rehearsal process that the first time we performed a little snippet where I say that I was dating a pimp, did I just say that in front of all these people sitting out here? You know, it's sort of like, wow, that's insane. But, you know, it's everyone's family has struggled. Everyone has losses and triumphs and tragedies.
Scenes from home movies performed by Rhode Island-based Everett Dance Theater, which has just celebrated its 20th anniversary year. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. Well, it's only a day after the new year began, and how many resolutions are already broken? Well, as a new book points out, and as you might guess, keeping a resolution is often a problem for several reasons. The kind of resolutions you make, the strategies that you have for keeping them, and underestimating just how hard it's going to be. MJ Ryan is author of the book, This Year I Will, and she joins us on the line. Welcome.
Hello, I'm happy to be with you, Deborah.
Many of us, unfortunately, have probably already broken some of the resolutions that we just made. Why are they so popular every New Year, resolutions? And why are they so popular when we know how hard they are to keep?
Well, I think that our capacity to change the things that we want to in our lives is one of the key wonderful things about being a human being. But I think that we underestimate what it actually takes, and we don't understand how our brain actually works. And the more we know that, then the easier it actually gets.
Well, how do we get our brain then to sort of go along with our optimism, if you will?
We have to know two things. One is that we really have two brains. We have a thinking brain, which is our neocortex, which says, I want to get in shape, for example. But then we have a feeling brain, and which we share with all mammals. And it only knows two things, safe or danger, pain or pleasure. And what it wants is easy, fun, and safe. And so even though our thinking brain can say, yes, let's get fit, when you have to get up at 6 o'clock and go to the gym, that doesn't feel so much fun. So the emotional brain goes, ugh, don't want to do it. And it sabotages our efforts.
So is it stronger?
Actually, everything that happens to us goes first to that feeling brain. So we need to get our emotions engaged when we really want to make a change. We want to have something we want strongly to go toward. So I'm working with this woman, for example, who has this little black dress, and she puts it in her bathroom. So she gets up in the morning, and she looks at that dress, which she no longer fits into, and she says, someday I'm going to wear you. And that keeps her emotional brain engaged in this thing that she really wants. Or I'm working with a guy who stopped smoking. And I said to him, why do you want to stop smoking? And he, you know, gave me the usual health reasons. I said, yeah, but under that, what do you really want from the feeling place? And he said, I want to be able to live long enough to retire and live on a beach like in Hawaii.
So this emotional brain isn't going to respond to the negative consequences, basically. If I smoke, I die kind of thing.
Well, it gets you scared. That's true. But if it's not fun and easy, you don't really go for it. One of the interesting studies about this was done on people who have had heart attacks. The doctor calls you in, you've had a heart attack, and says if you don't clean up how you're eating and what exercising, you're going to die. 90% of those people cannot stick with the changes they need to. Hmm. That proves to us that the scare tactic doesn't really work, at least in the long term.
Hmm. But your book, you also suggest, though, and I'm assuming this is an appeal to the thinking part of the brain, is looking at what need is being met by this particular thing that you're having trouble changing.
Yeah, so I think we have to understand why are you doing it in the first place. So let's say it's you're big in debt because you're overspending. Well, what emotionally are you being satisfied in you by shopping too much? There's a need under there, and the more that you understand what that is, then the more you can satisfy it some other way. So it's the need to feel excited. Well, what else could you be excited about besides purchases? Or the need to have meaning in your life. All right, how else can you find meaning besides at the mall?
And also, when looking at ways to make a change, there's part of the book that says, look at a new strategy for attaining this goal, but also look at what's helped you in the past. So that's a little different. So can you explain that?
Yeah, I think the key thing that actually helped people change anything is to say, how have I changed anything before? Because that means the pathway to do that already exists in your brain. One of the problems why I think people have such trouble with New Year's resolutions or any change is that they read all kinds of articles that tell them what to do. Well, guess what? That's that person's idea of what to do. When I was coming in the studio today, the young woman who was escorting me, she said, you know, I'm actually really good at this. I think of a goal and that I really want, and then I work towards it. Well, that's fabulous. So therefore, she can use that formula anytime she wants to change anything.
And generally, does it work, do you think, if it's broken down? Say, maybe not multiple resolutions, maybe one, and also measurable goals.
Yes. My secret vice is Project Runway. And the guy, Tim Gunn, on there, he comes in at some point every time in the show and goes, focus, people. And that's what we need to do when we really want to change something. It's going to take work. And the reason it takes work is the way, again, about how our brains are structured. Anytime we do something, our brains fire in a particular sequence. And when they fire in that sequence, they start to wire that way. So the more that we've done something habitually, the more our tendency it'll be to do it again without even thinking. So to do something different, it has to take a lot of practice. And in order to practice, we really need to be very specific. I tell people to create a SMART goal. Stands for specific, meaning you know exactly what you're going to do. If you say, well, I want to become more patient, I say, well, patient how? You mean not yell at my kids. Ah, that's specific. All right. Measurable. That's another one that you can tell. Am I yelling or not? You track right. It has to be attainable and realistic. That's the A and the R. You cannot, no matter who you are, no matter what diet you're on, you are not going to lose 40 pounds in a month. Mm-hmm. You know, so don't set that as your goal. And it needs to be time-bound. So you say, in the next 3 months, I'm going to exercise 30 minutes a day, every day. Okay, that's a SMART goal. You know what you're going to do. You know when you're going to do it. You know when you're going to assess how you're doing. And the more specific you can be, especially around these more vague things like work-life balance or enjoying life more, what do you mean by that? What actions would you actually be taking if you were doing it right?
Right. What if you had one single piece of advice that you could give to someone who was thinking about changing, a significant life change, what would that piece of advice be?
I think it's that no matter what it is, you're not going to do it perfectly. And the more that you recognize you will mess up, we don't even have a word for it in English. We say mess up, screw up, fail, make a mistake. What I call it is practice. You practice and practice and practice until you get better. The more that you recognize it as practice, well, I'm going to give this a try. How did that go? I tell people to do a post-game review, meaning after they did it, go, did that work? Right. Then and learn from that. Then the more that you'll get towards what you want. There's lots of fascinating research that shows that those of us who consider ourselves learners, meaning life is about learning, we're going to blow it, the more that we hold that attitude and we're okay and we actually learn from the things that we do, the more success we create. Those who expect to be perfect, those who have a fixed orientation, meaning that they expect that they won't ever do it wrong even once or they can't stand the idea of making a mistake, they tend to fail.
Mm-hmm. Did you make any resolutions this year?
I'm going to tackle the thing that's up for lots of people, which is how to have a little more fun and leisure time in my life. I'm going to make a vow not to work every single weekend. So it will be specific and measurable. I'm going to do at least one weekend a month off completely and see how I do.
Well, good luck.
Thank you. And what are you going to do for your resolution?
Oh, gosh.
Here's another key, because of the way your emotional brain works. Don't make one if you don't really want to put in the work.
Right.
Because what happens instead is that we've then set ourselves up for failure over and over. So I say to people all the time, it just didn't pass your do you really mean it test. Because if you did really mean it, you'd just keep trying until you did it right.
Oh, well, thanks.
My pleasure.
MJ Ryan's book is This Year I Will, How to Finally Change a Habit, Keep a Resolution, or Make a Dream Come True. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.